first recap, what we learned yesterday is that we learned what is a conformal transformation. The conformal transformation says your distance doesn't have to stay the same, and it can be off by a conformal factor. And the important thing is we have this conformal Kaelin equation. And then the most important thing you want to take home is you realize CFT on D dimensional and ADS on D plus one dimensional, we enjoy, at least in the group theory sense, they enjoy the same symmetry, which is SOD D2. Okay, so today, as promised, I'm going to start scratching the surface and starting talking about 2D CFT. So the, okay, I guess we should have a quick motivation. Why 2D? Well, very quickly, the first reason is because we can do it. I mean, it's really like in 2D you have more symmetries and you can find models that you can exactly solve, and people say, hey, I can solve it. And they just keep finding more models and solve them, right? So this, it's, life is simpler on 2D, or richer. And second, well, this course, as you might have remembered, has another name called String Theory Zero. So the second motivation coming from a string theory, you believe it or not, but they're talking about the strings moving in the space-time, so they swap some two-dimensional worksheet. So 2D CFT seem to be very useful to describe those worksheets. Okay, lightning motivation. And then today's plan is two parts. First of all, we're trying to do whatever we did yesterday again. And hopefully it's not boring. It's actually not boring, because that you will find the struct, the algebra is much richer, and you will find they are delicately related. So we'll do conformal algebra, well, transformation algebra again, and you realize this thing is infinite dimensional. And you can also find a subset called global conformal algebra. And this, you should know how many dimensions. I'll let you think about it, and we'll come to it. And then the second half, well, in between there is an interlude, is where we introduce the players in town, which I call the primary fields. But then in the second half, we're all actually going to demonstrate the power of conformal symmetry. And really, we're going to find some results. We're not going to do perturbations anymore, not going to write down any actions, but we're still getting results, which is amazing. So that has two little parts. We're looking at the correlation functions. So remember, our starting point is some bootstrap hypothesis, so that we are able to find the correlation functions of all fields without invoking a local action at all. Finding exact these things. And then I'm going to talk about the energy momentum tensor. See what the conformal symmetry tells us about it, and especially what it tells us about it in 2D. It's one like things is like, oh, I wish things are prettier. And in that case, it's actually prettier. So it's nice. Okay, so let's get started.
Is this two spatial dimensions?
Two dimensions. It's like string is the one space dimension and moving in time. So it's one plus one.
Okay.
One plus one. And well, I would call 2D is because from today onward, we're going to stay in Euclidean. So we're going to use the Euclidean time, and hopefully everybody can get their everything else they want by weak rotation. And I'll just stop worrying how that actually would happen. Okay, very good point. Starting today, we're living on Euclidean space. But it's secretly a Euclidean time and a Euclidean space. So 2D. Okay. So one thing really nice about this, remember yesterday I was like trying to solve for this conformal transformation. I was just throw some details under the carpet so you can go to read the appendix. We don't have to bother it on board. And this is really nice. You can do everything on board. So let's look at our conformal Killing equation. Now reads d equals 2. It reads this thing, and I change it to the delta because we're on Euclidean space. But come on. There's this mu and a nu or mi, ni in the proper Greek that they only take 0 and 1. So I can literally just list all the things. So it reads, well, this one vanished. So this is one of them. And then the other one, let's say I take both to be 0. And I get that. And this cancel. OK. Can anybody help me here? What is this trying to tell me? What this is yelling to me. So this is the so-called conformal Killing equation, and this is all it is. Or can I write in some more enlightened form? Is like a partial. It's like there is a function of u and a v. It's a two-component function, and I have partial f, partial x equals partial f, partial y, u, partial v, and the other one says partial u, partial y equals minus partial v, partial x. Yes? Does it make look enlightening? What does it look like? Very good. It's the Cauchy-Riemann condition says that this function should be holomorphic. And this tells us we should really, instead of staying in our plane, we should stay in our complex plane. It really tells us we should have just used complex variables. Our life would be much simpler because the solution says that it is holomorphic. But see, but at the beginning, without doing anything, you should really think about using complex coordinate anyway, because remember in the certain front end courses that we worked so hard on this complex plane. And this is a time when you harvest the crops. You can find some imaginary wheat or barley. And if you brew beer out of this, I'll guarantee the flavor will be complex. Okay, so let's move to complex coordinate. And what I'm trying to claim is the solution of this guy is just partial epsilon. OK, here's a notation, is that whenever it's not confusing, I'll not write the subscript anymore. And the epsilon is defined to be epsilon 0 plus I epsilon 1, epsilon bar, so epsilon 0 minus epsilon 1. And then this, if you actually do the change, as Cauchy-Riemann tells you, it really says that the epsilon bar does not depend on z. And then the epsilon doesn't depend on z bar. So this is what we mean by the solution is holomorphic functions. So this is amazing. So before, we said, well, it's only these certain transformations will make it a conformal. And this time says you can differ by anything as long as it's only a function of z in terms of the z coordinate, then it's all good. Any holomorphic function would work. In principle, I could do a Laurent expansion as our moral is always anything that can happen will happen. So this is the moral of the day. You can do anything. So it says, well, you take any function, it'll work. And you can check that if you can check the metric, if you write down the metric in 2D, and you can check in tutorial, this is equals dz, dz bar. And this is very, make it very clear if you do a z goes to fz, z bar goes to f bar z bar, then you pick up two Jacobian, and that will give you the conformal factor that omega square x over there. So omega square x will be equals to partial f, partial z, partial f bar, partial z bar for any holomorphic function. So it doesn't have to be infinitesimal either. But since our goal, the next, so the, our goal number 1.1, finding the transformation has achieved. So let's move to the second and go, let's find the algebra. And remember, we find the algebra in the same way. We find the generators and find the commutators of them. So remember, yesterday we have the spirit of, say, this is actually true in two dimension. It's not hypothetical. This is actually true for the two-dimensional free scalar. That then you say, we can do this, but then we're going to expand it. Oh, sorry, I should use z. Now that we're on the complex plane, minus this epsilon z. Let me just take one of them, one of the modes. Then I'm going to expand it. Right? And the moral of the story yesterday is I can identify delta phi to be something like omega times j generator acting on phi. And you see that I probably lost factor of minus signs and the i's, but those are just conventions. Those are making our generators yesterday look like the momentum and angular momentum we learned. I mean, today we don't have them, so I'll just choose this. And you can immediately read off the generator today acquires the name of Ln is minus Zn plus 1 partial. And just read. Okay. Now we can just find the algebra. Let's do the commutator. Yeah, this commutator is simple enough. Remember you said the commutator was crazy? If you look at the lecture notes, the appendix. Yeah, this one we can do it on board. Then we're just doing commutators, and this one has n plus 1 partial. And then you switch them. Right? And you can erase some minus signs. The only thing that will make it not commute is because this partial acting on that is the first term. Because the partial acting partial is going to be canceled by this partial acting on partial. So the only thing that remains from this first term is this guy. It's just using product rule. Partial acting on this, give me this term. Partial. This guy still stay here. And the other term I claim is going to be canceled. And the next term I just switch and then M. And then this gives me M minus N, Z to the N plus M plus 1 partial, which I can identify it as minus N minus M. And I combine the minus with that bunch of things, give me this. I'm not going too fast, right? This is a derivative of polynomials. So hopefully it's not too fast. Yeah.
Actually, we have a sum, right? We have the epsilon. We say we have this infinite Laurent expansion.
Yeah.
And epsilon is our infinitesimal transformation
yeah.
that we do. But should we then have some kind of summation in the argument?
Yeah.
Because we do this, we can do this like component.
Yeah, sure.
Part.
I have this
okay.
argument, but I claim that each individual generator is just.
So we have these LNs, and there are lots of these.
There are infinite numbers.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
This whole.
Yeah. Very good. We should emphasize this a lot because this is a prettiness of the 2D conformal algebra, which I'll rewrite it here. Is this thing is infinite dimensional? And the n and the m literally runs from minus infinity to infinity. And then, I didn't do it, but hopefully you will be convinced the anti-holomorphic part will have the exactly same thing. And why wouldn't it? And then you should be also convinced that they don't talk to each other. So I have two copies of this infinite dimensional algebra. And this is our local conformal algebra. And I hope that I already demonstrated that life on two dimensional is definitely easier. So we already got the infinite dimensional algebra.
Is that some kind of your soul algebra? Or it's like
Very good. So this is known as the weight algebra. And then there is this Virasoro algebra we will light in the heart of tomorrow's lecture, which is the quantum version of this. So we're doing classical.
Yeah.
Then it's basically, it claims that it has a central charge. So there is a piece coming with a constant. It literally is a constant. It's not a generator. But you can include that constant in your algebra, and then your algebra have acquire a different term. And tomorrow, the goal is to find that term. So yes. So that will be our quantum version of this algebra, and that will be our goal tomorrow. And with that found, then we can find the representation of that algebra, and we claim, and we find the states, and we claim we will solve it. That's the goal tomorrow, to find the quantum version, which is another piece, and we'll spend 50 minutes laying grounds for how to find this algebra, and spend hopefully 5 minutes to write down that algebra. Now that's the plan tomorrow. But let's come back to this plan. This plan says we have a very, very, very rich algebra, which we call it a local, for the following reason. Because it's not everywhere defined if you look at our pretty generator. So this thing, I'll be worried because in particular, z equals 0, all z equals infinity is worrisome because it's not defined sometimes. So for example, well, hopefully I can convince you everywhere else it's well defined. Okay, so at z equals 0, and we hope the exponent is at least greater or equal to 0. Otherwise, you have some infinity in your generator, which is make it not well-defined at that point. So this tells us n should be bigger or equal to minus 1. OK, so what do I do with infinity? Well, we have conformal symmetry. Infinity is like 0, right? So it tells us we should just do the inverse transformation, which yesterday I sort of waved my hands, so it's definitely in the conformal transformation. It is a conformal transformation, and it will relate it to the special conformal transformation. So let's do this and see what happens. The problem is I have to first figure out what's partial omega, but this I should be able to figure out because this is chain rule. And the partial z over omega is minus 1 over omega squared. So now I can switch gear, says this one is actually minus 1 over omega to the n plus 1 times minus omega squared partial omega, which gave me omega to the minus n plus 1 partial omega. Okay. Still, college year 1 calculus, or maybe high school calculus for you guys. Okay, so we get this thing, and now omega is at 0. Then by the same argument, at omega equals 0, we have minus n plus 1 bigger or equals to 0, so we say n must be smaller or equals to 1. So if you want this transformation to be everywhere defined to be a global conformal transformation, you require basically say L minus 1, L 0, L 1, and then the anti-holomorphic guys. That's it. Everyone following? The only thing I'm demanding is that there shouldn't be 1 over zeros in my generators. There's nothing fancy. Should we be happy about this result? Why there were 6 of them?
Is it close? Is it obvious?
You can just look at them, right? The 1 minus 1, 0 will never give you anything bigger than that. Okay, that's a very good sanity check. Is it closed? It is. Check number 2. Counting exercise. I count 6. So there are 6 generators. And should I expect 6? Well, by that argument, right? So now it's like 2. I'll ignore the fact that I have time dimension because I'm in Euclidean. But it should be like something that, just for the number of generator purpose, it should be equals to SO4, which indeed have 6 generators. So not bad. We'll get more serious about this right now. But if you just counting that we're not doing too bad yet. So let's say what these generators do, and you call them L subscript 100. What do they do? Well, let's go back to look at what they do. This guy is corresponding to, if we look back to that expansion, n equals minus 1 corresponds to the transformation is a minus 1 z to 0. It's clearly a minus 1, right? See, that Laurent expansion tells me what my generators are. And of course, if I pick a specific generator, I can ask what's the corresponding shift is. And this corresponding transformation, in this case, is a number. And then we, of course, whenever we say this, we happily associate this with translation. Okay, L0. Epsilon is equals to A0 times Z. Okay. And yes, somebody said that it seems to be dilatation. Well, if we consider A0 to be real, but since A0 is complex, I can write it as some sort of R times E to the I phi Z. So this part gives us the dilatation, and this part will give us the rotation. So this thing, you can make it the more precise. You can actually look at, so remember L0 is defined to be minus Z partial, see? You can actually using radial coordinate to figure out what is L0, what is L0 bar. And you can really identify as L0 plus L0 bar is something like R partial R, which looks like your dilatation operator yesterday. And then you can also identify L0 minus L0 bar with an I in front is something like a partial phi, maybe with minus signs. Just check the notes. It's done. And this is the translation in the angular direction, which is the rotation. And in 2-dimensional, we only have 1 rotation. Okay, not too bad. See, now what do you think L1 will give me? By process of elimination, we got a translation, rotation, dilatation. This got to be giving me the special conformal transformation. Well, let's see. So this guy says my transformation is A1 Z squared. Huh. this looks much simpler than whatever I showed you yesterday. But let's manipulate a little bit, and I say I claim this guy is equivalent to this. Well, that's not enough. So let's say the finite version of this infinitesimal is this guy, which you can just expand. This is, if this thing is small, this thing is equals to z times 1 plus a1z. And this is the z, the second term is the infinitesimal. Okay, so I convinced you this is indeed the finite version. And you're like, still not very enlightening. No worries. We know what's special conformal. It's very good. We have a goal in mind and we know it what it is. We just have to prove it is. So let's do the Euler trick. Say let's consider the inverse because we know it's related to inverse somehow. So this guy is 1 over W tuta. And this is 1 over W. This is minus A1, 1 over W plus 1. And I can multiply by some W's to make things prettier. And I can just say, look, it's an inverse translation, inverse. Very good. So this guy is my special conformal transformation. So this is really demonstrated each individual generator is mapped to what we have learned before. And this is known as the global conformal transformation because it's everywhere defined. And we can actually make it look even prettier. Because what do we have so far? We have a translation and a linear thing and this thing. We can smash them all together. Says the global transformation is really defined by this guy. And your one of your exercise this afternoon is to figure out what each individual corresponds to. And I show you this fun fact. In conformal field theory, never worry about the 3 points. You can always put the 3 points at the 0, 1, infinity. It's really cute. I can make the argument right now. You have 3 points. I bring a point to 0, inverse it through the infinity. If you don't do inverse again, it'll be fine. You move another one to 0. You dilate the other one to 1. Done. You actually showed exactly how that happened today in the tutorial with like hand holding 15 steps, something like that. Okay. But this really capture all these little things in this form says this is really all the global transformation we have. Yes?
I have some problems counting the parameters that we can give these transformations because if we have 6 generators, then we should have 6 independent parameters, right?
Yeah. So this is.
So we have 1 translation.
2. There is L1 bar.
Fine, yeah, sorry.
There is bar.
Yes.
And so there is 1 rotation, 1 dilatation, 2 conform, special conform. Yeah. I thought I could save half the time if I never write these bar things.
Yeah.
yes.
How should I understand this, those special conformal transformations? I mean, like you.
It's the inverse followed by the translation followed by inverse.
But why that is so important?
Because that makes your conformal group, global conformal group, close. Remember yesterday, there is this beautiful algebra lasts like 15 lines. And eventually we make some redefinition says, oh, look, this is the symmetry group of ADSD plus 1. If you don't have these special conformal transformation, then you would never make that claim. That's
so that is some kind of leftover transformation to make group complete.
Right, if you only include dilatation, like the scale invariance is what we want. But if you only include this and translate and rotation, it doesn't complete. And you can just derive. Actually, it's much easier to say from this algebra, right? If you have 0 and minus 1, 1 has to come out. Do it this way. Does it? No, it doesn't. OK. Maybe it doesn't. OK, I'll figure out why. But I mean, they are there. If you solve your conformal Kaelin equation, it's the conformal transformation. Then no, it doesn't. You don't have to include L1. But you do want to have inverse in your, well, one thing, one the other argument is what people says that if you require unitarity and relativistics, any scale in, okay, so far people find any scale invariant theory will be necessary conformal invariant. Conformally invariant. So your special conformal transformation is always there.
Yeah. That line before the L1 and L1 bar, you say
yes.
The right hand side is the finite portion of the infinitesimal one.
Yes.
But when you multiply out z and multiply by 1, it's like.
We always define the tutor equals z plus epsilon. So epsilon is that one. Right?
You will never consider the part that doesn't. What's the leftover is the infinitesimal. Okay.
So this somehow also known as the symmetry of Möbius group or something. It's related to some particular 2D surface that always pop out in string theory. But the point is, this really capture all the global conformal transformation. And you're like, no. You have 4 complex numbers before we have 3. The counting was wrong. Your Cine detect didn't work out. Well, come on. If I just scale ABCD by a factor of 2, it's the same transformation. So I really should demand something, say this guy, such that I can't just randomly scale them by a factor. So that now we are happy. We killed one.
Why did you
demand it? Because this I can just write for each one of this transformation, I can just happily put my 4 numbers together and call it a matrix. And this is a very thin to demand because I want to demand the matrix determined to be 1. I want to kill a parameter anyway. And one way to kill a parameter is demand this matrix to be unit determined. And you can do other demands. You also say I demand A equals 1, but this is cuter in the following way. It is cuter because this is what I'm claiming is that the global conformal group of our 2D conformal transformation is the same as a bunch of 2x2 matrices with unit determined, which you might know them as SL2C because the parameter is taken from C. So there are 2x2 special linear, linear algebra give us matrices. So this group has a name. This matrix is form a group and it has a name. It's called a special linear 2C. And furthermore, you realize there's one more thing we can't kill by this, is I can still flip the sign of them, which means there is a Z2 we should divide it by to actually get what our global conformal group is. So this is actually our global conformal group, which is captured by this, with this demanding, and with the identification of ABCD to minus A, minus B, minus C, minus D. And this, it's a group theory fact that the people have shown somewhere. This thing is identical to SO31, which is what we expected. Remember, we started with 2 dimensions. We started with like 2, 0. And what we learned yesterday is that if you include conformal symmetry, it will enhance it to 2 plus 1, 1, 0 plus 1, which is 3, 1. So this global conformal transformation completely mapped to what we have learned yesterday. Yes?
Are we constraining the possible conformal transformation?
No, we're not constraining anything because this demand is just saying that before we're counting redundantly. So if we have A, B, C, D,
that describe exactly the same transformation if I have 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D. So if I don't put this constraint, you are just counting infinite like two parameters redundancy in your counting. And then I want to get rid of that redundancy. I only want to count my conformal transformation once. Because let's look, if I claim that I want to add a 2 here, then I can just take the 2 out and cancel it.
Yeah.
So that describes the same transformation. I don't want to double counting. And then I'm actually infinitely bold counting. And I don't want that. But like if I demand this, the only thing remaining is the double counting. Then if I divide it that away, so this really, really describes exactly the transformation we have. Yes.
In that case, SO31 is
Lorentz.
It's Lorentz, right? So
yep.
Does it necessarily mean that we have a two-dimensional representation for Lorentz?
Yeah.
But even if it's complex, then probably we can use it to do something.
It's true.
We
can probably use it to do something. Well, Spinner?
Why would you?
But while spinner is the left representation, either left or right.
Right.
So mm-hmm. it's like we decompose it already. So it's actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. That's asymptotic. Okay. I can try to figure out why that claim is true. But it is true that those two groups are identical. I can try to figure it out. I can't think of right now. I don't know the answer right now. Okay, so we have done our point number one. Is say, let's do everything we did yesterday again in half the time. And find not only the local conformal group and the global one. And do I want to say anything else before moving on? Nope, we're good. Okay, so players in town, before we talk about the power of conformal. Well, let's say the VIP players in town. Something called a primary field, and this is since it's a 45-minute mark. Let's see, primary fields. Okay, before I say that, I should make a disclaimer, sorry. It's actually important because you just have gone through 6 weeks or 8 weeks of QFT. So fields in conformal field theory is equals to operators. So in fields, when we talk about the fields when you're learning QFT, what we meant is whatever show up in the action and whatever has been integrated over in the past integral, and that's the fundamental field. But look, we don't have an action. The only thing is we have a bunch of things that depends on Z, is locally defined objects. So in conformal field theory, I write down a phi, this is the field. I write down any derivative field, this is phi, that's a field, that's a new field. And if I write random things like exponential it of the phi, it's still a field. As long as it's locally defined, it's called a field, it's called operators, they are the same. It's just the terminology. And we claim we always have an infinite number of fields in conformed field theory, but don't get worried about it. It's like that they told you there are infinite number of operators in field theory. They are exactly the same. Whenever I mention fields, they mean operators. So sometimes I might use phi, sometimes I use O, and they're interchangeable. As long as I don't use in the same equation, I think it would be fine. Okay, and now we can talk about, so primary fields in conformal field theory is like American politics. Like Republican primary fields, they have entertainment value, and thank you for the people who laughed. But like the Democrat primary fields, they actually have practical purposes. Okay, so
So let's look at these guys. Before I define these guys, let's move slowly. Some definitions to follow. Hopefully, we'll finish in 2 minutes and move on to the physics. So first, there is a definition called the chiral field. Chiral field is just as if there is a field that only depends on Z, has no depends on Z bar whatsoever, we call it chiral. And if, on the other hand, it only have dependence on Z bar, we call it anti-chiral. Let me make a bar on it. Okay? Just definitions. And the next thing we want to define is we look at the transformation of a field under scaling. So if I go from z to lambda z, and I wonder how my field transforms, you write a phi tilde at z, and z bar, I wonder what this equals to. And this equals to, if it equals to this guy, then I guess there should be a bar there, and there should be a bar here. Then I claim this field has conformal weight of H bar. I mean, this is not something alien. You scale your distance by a factor, and then your field could transform in some way. And this is really, okay, there is subtle differences, but at this time, you can just consider as what's the naive counting tell you. Something like scalar field has dimension 1 in 4D, fermion has 3/2 and stuff. So these are just these ones, but in the 2D language, they have this H and H bar. And if you get a field and you do the scaling transformation, you will gather this HH bars. And then there are some comments. So these guys are real. I mean, it's a scaling dimension. And in today's tutorial, which there is one question highlighted that you really should do because tomorrow's lecture is depending on it, is telling us that the scaling is somehow related to Hamiltonian on a cylinder. Scaling in 2D in this radial direction somehow related to Hamiltonian. Interesting. I like that problem. And it's really a simple problem. So that tells us, I mean, it's related to Hamiltonians, and that's the eigenvalue, which should be real. And if you look at, if you take lambda to be some RE to the I phi, and plug it in, you realize this R part gives you the scaling, and the other part gave you the rotation. So I'm trying to claim something like H plus H bar is the eigenvalue of the dilatation that we just made, and H minus H bar is the rotation. So this eigenvalue should be real, and this one should also be real because the 2D rotation gave you sort of a 2D spin thing. So these conformal weights are real. And at the last lecture, we'll also show they actually needs to be bigger or equal to zero if unitarity is true. But we'll defer that. But at this point, we'll just say, if some field you transform, then we can claim it has conformal weight. It's a definition. And now we can finally define primary field.
Sorry.
Yep.
It just says if it doesn't depend on, it only depends on Z. So, okay, I can
write this. It just says it only depends on the holomorphic part and doesn't depend on the anti-holomorphic part. It's called a chiral. It's just a bunch of pretty peculiar nice fields. And the reason of why, well, I mentioned it, would be clear by the end of the class. There are some very special things that we love that happens to be chiral. But at some point, in 5 minutes, I'll assume everything is chiral anyway, just because I can't just keep tracking of everything. Just assuming the other parts are there. They can be. But they are actually good, they're actually real things. It's not like in our life we only have these kind of fields. I mean, they're actually important fields. They are actually chiral. But we'll come to that, I promise, at the end. Okay, but let's now finally define our primary field. Primary field, they are very important. As you say, they call them VIP players that will write a big phi. And it just says that this property is preserved if it's any conformal transformation. So you can imagine that this fz can be any function of z. Think about how rich our conformal transformations are. And the primary field are the particular nice fields such that no matter which function you pick, it is still transformed this way. Okay, I probably should explain why they are called the VIP players. So this is what conformal field theory trying to do is that, so conformal field theory says, the hypothesis says we want to solve all the correlation functions of all the fields without doing anything beyond the conformal symmetry and some requirements like unitarity and stuff. And that could only work if two miracles happens. So the two miracles are, first of all the correlation functions are somehow related to the correlation functions of primary fields. And this will actually hopefully show in the last lecture, is that at least in 2D CFT, we can show that, if you want to get all the correlation functions, fine. Just find the correlation functions of all your primary fields and do some differential operation on it. That will give you everything else. So first is we only care about our VIP players. Second is we only have a finite of them. I mean, if you have an infinite number of primary fields, you are still in trouble. And in 2D CFT, that's why we love it so much, both miracles happen. Yep.
Could you repeat why we can find all correlation functions from the primary field?
So from the primary field, so we are soon, literally soon, like 1 minute later, we're going to find the primary field of correlation functions.
At least we'll find the two-point function. We will find a three-point function in the tutorial. And we'll find everything else, ask Pedro. Hota is going to tell us how to find them, right? The bootstrap.
So you first find those, and the miracle in 2D conformal field theory that we can show by some counterintegral argument is that all the other fields are decedents of the primary field. And we're going to define the decedent, I can't pronounce them, are the children of primary field. And then we're going to define these children in the last class. And the conformal, like all the other fields you can think of, are just children of these, and that they are some sort of like a differential operator acting on this field, or some differential integral operator acting on these. And what can be shown is that for any other correlation functions that are correlation functions of these children fields, they can be written as some differential operators of the correlation functions you found of the primary field. So the only thing we need to do, but that's what we're going to prove in the last class, because it needs some fun facts, which we call. So I just have to wait. I'm just telling you that we will have to wait on this and wait on that. But at this point, just say that I'm just trying to say that these things are very important, because if we figure out things about this, then we're done. Because the goal of solving the theory, if you know all correlations of all fields, and then what else you need to know? Okay, right. So
let's wait on that, and we'll find this children field to the last day. And we'll actually, because that's when, after we find the Virasoro algebra, which is the main goal tomorrow, and then we find the representation, then we, for each primary field, and you can find all the children and build the infinite tower of them. Okay, but now let's move on to the physics. The second part is the power of conformal symmetry. And I'm really excited because this is really one that you say, hey, I only know that this field enjoy conformal symmetry. And then we can do everything. Okay, let's do everything. Okay. Well, I mean, in my point of view, if you do 2-point, 3-point, then that's almost everything, right? And Pedro has a good argument why that's almost everything. Well, in his particular words, it's like, it's going to be very, very painful to get more than 3-point functions, but you can do it. Like, all the information is there. It might be really painful and the result doesn't look pretty. And when at the prettiest moment, it looks like hypergeometric functions, but you can do it. Okay, in principle. Okay, power of conformal symmetry. This thing is very powerful. By considering, so, sorry, I have one more thing to say, is that these are the awesome players, and there are some slightly less awesome players called a quasi-primary field. These are just say that that is only true under the global transformation. So if it works for any f, it's a primary field. But if it only works for the global transformation, which is particular AZ plus B over CZ plus D hiding in some board. And if that's the only, okay. So if it's only true for the global, it's a quasi-primary field. And you're, of course, all the primary are quasi-primaries. And the inverse is not true. And we're going to see an example tomorrow, but we're going to see it today. We don't know that it's the reverse is not true until tomorrow. We'll see that example at the end of today. Okay. So let's calculate. Okay, let me keep my life simple and consider quasi-chiral primary field so that I only write phi z and phi w. And I say, I want to calculate this thing without knowing anything. I have no action. The only thing I know is, OK, let's label them. This is 1, this is 2, and put it into 2 points. The only thing I know is this 2 are 2 quasi-primary field. And I decided to calculate this. Yep.
What's the definition of this bracket?
It's not defined yet. But it's a correlation function. So it's a physical thing. And what a conformal symmetry tell me is that if after I perform a conformal transformation, become a tutors, they should be the same.
Is that a vacuum expectation value? I mean, yeah, like if, okay. Are you going to define it?
In... Tomorrow we'll see the vacuum.
But here
it is just some physical thing. So this is literally, I can write this as a function zw. So it's a function depending on the two location, and I want to find this function.
But like when we discuss about the correlation function in the statistical physics context and the quantum field theory context, like sometimes we. We always introduce action so that we know what is the weight of the probability distribution, but here we are not introducing anything, right?
No, we're not. So we're just saying actually we're trying to, after we write down the 3-point function, we're actually going to use the correlation function data to define this conformal field theory. So we have a bunch of correlation function. And we're using the correlation function, and we claim that is the definition of the conformal. It is the theory of study.
Then,
because we don't know action.
Then, like, it doesn't have even mathematical or formal definition. It only its own ground. It just doesn't have, like, we just occasionally write down
two things,
and
put
the bracket, and that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, at this point, that's it. Well, we don't know any action. What else do we expect me to do? I can't do parse integral. Although, I'll invoke that at some point. But no, at this point is you put the two field in a bracket and you try to, and the only thing you demand is after I perform a conformal transformation, this thing doesn't change because it's supposed to be physical. So the only demand now is we demand this thing to be physical. Okay, and then I claim that will help us exactly solve this thing. Okay, so what we do now is I'm just going to plug this thing over there, and I pick up a factor of partial f, partial g to the power h1, partial f, partial w to the h2, and then change the location at f, g, change the location at f, w, and on the other side, it should be the same. It's still g, z dot w.
So we assume that it's a quasi-primary field?
They are quasi-primary field. So these are chiral quasi-primary. So let me you assume it's a quasi-primary, it's a plus, right? Because you're assuming less. Quasi-primary are less awesome. And even about the less awesome things, we can still say awesome things about them. They are less awesome. They only require global transformation. The primary has a stronger constraint. It wants all kinds of transformation. This one requires less. And we can still say a lot about them. So first thing we're going to say is we have translation symmetry. So this thing must be a function of the difference, just by translation. One of these global things, right? And then the next thing we're going to say is suppose Fz is a scaling, then this one really tells me lambda to the h1, lambda to the h2 at some different location, z, lambda w, which by definition, this guy is g, lambda z minus w. And this, by conformal symmetry requirement, should equal that. So taking another specific transformation, i.e. the dilatation, okay. Then you just plug it in. This is lambda, and this is lambda. This is lambda z, lambda w, but by definition, that's g at lambda z and lambda w. But this whole thing, supposed to be physical, which equals that, and which means you can solve this. This is an equation for function g, and then you can solve this equation, and the answer should be d 1, 2, z minus w to the power h1 plus h2. Now this is a function. If you scale this by lambda, it will pick up lambda to the h1 plus h2 on denominator, cancel the thing in front, didn't change. So this is our correlation function. It should look like this. Because this is a thing that doesn't change under a dilatation.
May I ask a question, like invisible, like I mean, it has the same functional form as no tilde function?
No, it doesn't. It has this form. It has precisely this form. The tilde is equal to this. I'm just saying if you...
Then
you, but because you have a physical, that's the physical requirement.
Yeah.
It's only in the bracket you have the tilde and the tilde equals to this. So this line is what conformal symmetry gave us. If you say that we're in a conformal field theory, that all the physical objects shouldn't depend on the conformal transformation. They are only equal in the brackets. And that's, that, from here, that's how we derive. So this is equal to this. There's nothing fancy I did on the left. I copied over the primary field transformation, except that it's cheating and drop the anti-holomorphic part.
Because I just want to consider chiral field at this point. So the left is really say, they are primary field. And the right is say, this thing should be physical, shouldn't it depend on the conformal transformation. Okay, so we already solved this. Well, actually, but not quite. Because if we consider our favorite inverse, we'll see, so we're gonna do, so this line is the important line. We're gonna do this again. So this is when we did it for the dilatation. It picked up some factors. And then it should be the same. Then we do this again. For the inverse, you get minus 1 over z squared, which is a partial f partial z to h1. And then you get a minus 1 over w squared to h2. And then you get the g, now at the location 1 over z minus 1 over w. By conformal symmetry, it should be equals to g z minus 1. I'm just applying that line again to a different function f, which is 1 over z.
Will we just say that it has to depend on the difference because it's
the translation. Yeah.
So that's always true. Right?
That's always true.
Okay.
Yep. And then we have this thing. Let's plug in there. Okay. Because this factor is going to do that. It's going to look ugly. I'll write down the results. It takes few lines, not that many, but let's not do it because it's a bunch of algebra. Basically, it says what we require is it equals to that g z minus w thing, but actually it doesn't. It has this weird factor. So the only thing we're doing is using what so far what do we already have, and then plug 1 over z, 1 over w here, just squeeze this guy here, and do some fraction manipulation, this is the result. And the only important about this result is it doesn't look like what I have, unless I demand h1 equals h2. Then this funny factor all dropped off. So the moral of the story is that the two-point correlation function, which I don't know what it is yet, but if this thing is physical, it becomes d12, delta h1, h2. It only works if I have two primary fields of the same dimension. And it precisely scale like this. And you have some d12 on top. But you can just scale your primary field together to make your d12 or dij look nice. So those are just normalization factors. And there's no physics there. But so far, what we have claimed is that in conformal field theory, the two-point functions are completely fixed, only because you demand conformal symmetry. It has nothing to do with which theory you're worried about. But any conformal field theory, if it exists a correlation function as defined by the Parse integral, by this argument, the two-point function is always like this. So given me any theory, well-defined theory, you can write down the correlation function. It has to look like this because that's demanded by the symmetry argument. Okay. ready to charge onward for three-point function? Not really. We have a whole tutorial to wait for us. We'll do that in the tutorial. But it's basically you do exactly the same thing. So now there's z1, z2, z3. For example, your first argument is that this thing can only depend on, okay, let me define some notation. z12 is equals to z1 minus z2. This thing can only depend on z1 minus z2, z2 minus z3, z1 minus z3, because the translation argument. And then there is the dilatation argument will fix whatever is in your denominator, almost. And then the inverse argument will actually fix all the exponent on your denominator. But let's save it for the tutorial. It's slightly more complicated. But the point is, the result is this. It's very symmetrical. Okay. And these things are known as the structure constants of conformal field theory. It is, again, it's almost completely determined except a bunch of constants. And since we already normalized our field with the other constants, so this constant is actually known as the juicy part. So everything you want to know about a conformal field theory is captured by here. So if you continue your reading about bootstrap hypothesis, then you can bootstrap the rest and says these are the only important thing. So Pedro actually decided, says, so the conformal field theory is actually defined by a bunch of HIs, which are, okay, HI, HI bars, defined by a bunch of conformal weight plus the structure constant. That's the definition of the CFT. Oh, okay, plus some bootstrapped equations. So this bootstrap equation is just some consistency conditions these numbers has to satisfy. So you can't just pick any number. These numbers have to satisfy some consistency condition, which says, basically says, suppose I consider a four-point function, I can fuse the first two operator together, all I can fuse the first and the third operator together, it should give me the same result, is where these bootstrap equations come from. But these are those, oh, okay, where is the, yeah, so I'll consider this as the most important result today, is these numbers. Not this whole thing, just these numbers. These guys are very important, because this is the CFT. We're defining CFT with some conformal weights and some structure constants. Okay, let me at this point make some comments. So the first comment is everything said so far, it will just work out if I include the other dependents. So if I go through the trouble to keep the z bars around, it will work out. And you will just have the z12 bar to the h1 bar. And you can see this can be really, really long. And you can see why I don't want to write it, because I still have one more thing to talk about. But I will go through. You just have a really, really long equation. So that's the first comment. Second comment is, so far we only use the global transformation, which is why we can deal with quasi-primary field, which means since we only use the global conformal transformation, I have just spent some part of the class to show the global conformal transformation are the ones we learned yesterday, which means that everything we say so far goes through for the higher dimensional CFT as well. You can just say this, you can just go back to the X mu, which in the D dimension. Then in the D dimension, again, your two-point function is completely determined up to some normalization function. Your three-point function is completely determined up to the structure constants. And then you can bootstrap the four-point function and relate some cross ratios. And that's also deferred to today's tutorial. All right, so the first triumph of CFT, look, we didn't write down the action. And it's certainly not any perturbation. It's the exact results. We demand the symmetry. Symmetry tells us the correlation function has to look like this. Okay? I hope you are happy. I'm happy. I'm happy. So let's move on to the last topic, but not the least, the energy momentum tensor. Well, I hope I don't need to give a motivation for why we should study energy momentum tensor. They tend to be important in our life. I don't know, we always study them. Okay, so what I want to say about the energy momentum tensor is recall that Noether theorem tells us, if suppose I have a Poincaré, we come back to this Poincaré thing again. Suppose I have a Poincaré transformation that is the simple Killing equation. And if we have a Killing vector, which we know what they are, but if I not write them, then I can make a make current out of this. And another Noether tells us that this current is conserved.
But that's only the translation. That's not
the Poincaré translation. Sure, it's just the translation, even better. Even better. No, but the point is this current is conserved. And if this current is conserved, the energy momentum tensor satisfies this conservation law as well. I think this is, at least some of you should have this relativity interview question as well. So if you find a Killing vector, it's good enough to promote the T mu nu as a current, and such that we can find a current that is conserved, then we can define a charge, which we will do next time. But this is what translations tell us. But now we have conformal symmetry, which we still want to build a current with our conformal Killing vector and the T mu nu. And we still want to demand this thing is conserved, is zero. Because it's a symmetry. In symmetry, we should be able to define such a current that's conserved. Then what we get is this thing plus the other thing. This thing is already conserved because conformal symmetry is just a bigger symmetry. But this thing, I can write it twice because it's symmetric. And to replace it by whatever the conformal Killing equation tells me, which is 2 over d, partial dot epsilon, e to mu nu, t mu nu, doesn't matter. This part of the argument has not been applied to 2d yet. So this gave me something, some factor that doesn't matter. But this is the trace of the energy momentum tensor. I want it to be zero because we want the current to be conserved. So basically, what I'm trying to say is conformal symmetry tells us that T is traceless. So before, we have some translations who tells us the energy momentum tensor should satisfy this guy. Let's call it a divergent free condition. And the conformal symmetry tells us it should be traceless.
Only it's symmetric, right?
So we always use the gravitational definition of the energy momentum tensor. And there is actually the additional reading online coming from last year's homework to show that how do you find the canonical version of the energy momentum tensor of the electromagnetic mechanism, and how do you find the gravitational version, and you compare them, you find the gravitational, it's just nicer because it's symmetric and it has all sorts of property. You can also say from that homework that energy momentum tensor is indeed traceless, and thus you prove that electrodynamics is actually conformally mirrored.
Yeah, but if you relate this to conservation laws, then isn't the Noether energy momentum more trustworthy? Because the other one is just a coupling to gravity. I mean, how do we know that this thing has any significance when it comes to this conservation laws? I mean, it is nicer structure, mm-hmm. yeah, because it's symmetric, but it doesn't, like, it's not really like a...
They should be only different by some divergence, some, like, surface.
That's the question,
Well, you can check out that homework and look at the specific form and see if the difference is indeed okay. Okay, but this is what conformal theory tells us, is that our energy momentum tensor is traceless. And from here, what we want to do is, let's come back to D equals 2. Because as hopefully I have shown you that everything is prettier in D equals 2. It's just simpler. Now let's just write out all the components. There are not that many. Let's see, there are three of them. And in something called general relativity tells us that I can always relate an energy momentum tensor to the other one. Sorry, I'm just trying to figure out the index. I mean, this is very familiar to everybody. Put some prime somewhere here. Is that if I have an energy momentum tensor and I have some coordinate transformation, which what I'm referring to is the z equals x0 plus I minus 1. Z bar equals x0 minus I x1. See, these are very nice coordinate transformations. You can just plug it in. And then before we have t00, t01, t11. And now we have tzz, tzz bar, tz bar, z bar. And you're like, why am I doing this? Ah, the good thing is if you do that, which is the first problem of the tutorial, you find first this guy vanish. By using the traceless and the conservation condition, you'll find this guy vanish. Isn't that nice? And you're like, huh, what if it would be so much nicer if tzz is just a function of z, tz bar, z bar is just a function of z bar. And the miracle happens again, that's the case. So, conformal theorem trait demands that if you have a 2D CFT, instead of the energy momentum tensor is really equivalent to a chiral T field and an anti-chiral T bar field. So that's why at the beginning I said, well, these chiral fields, they're important. Look, all the energy momentum tensor in 2D CFT, they are chiral. They are chiral and anti-chiral. So this is the first problem of today's tutorial, is to use the conformal symmetry, i.e. the divergent-free, the conservation, the traceless, to find out our 2D energy momentum tensor is just a chiral field and the anti-chiral field.
So we have just T of Z, and
yeah,
and then minus T of Z bar on the other one, or because that's the trace field. Or how does the energy momentum tensor look like in that case?
Well, your trace-free condition is T mu nu.
Oh yeah, but we're still taken, right? So
T mu nu, right? But your T mu nu is not diagonal anymore, right? In complex coordinate, this is this. So your this is your metric. Mm-hmm. So this is actually, if you just use this. Well, okay, already done one line of your tutorial. You just do this and you realize that's the only thing that cares, so of course it's zero. Done. You just have to prove the other one. All right. So now this is good time to stop. We find out the conformal field theory in 2D is cuter, and we have some cuter results. And tomorrow we'll charge forward as planned by Jens, that we're going to find a very sorry algebra. And Yeah, I'll try my best to organize my tutorial such that there is some priority, that what exactly what I want to do in order, such that it's more helpful. You can consider the rest if you didn't finish as the appendix of the lecture notes. Oh, I can come again tomorrow, Wednesday, if you have any questions. Okay, but I should stop here.